Welcome to Striving for Consensus, Current and Future Management of HER2 Low and Ultra Low Breast Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Drs. Mark Pegram, Joyce O'Shaughnessy, and Peter Schmid for a think tank style discussion. To begin, Professor Schmid discusses strategies to identify patients with HER2 low and ultra low disease.
So we're moving into treating breast cancer in different ways. We've moved away largely from defining oncogenic drivers, because that has been a strategy where we have made some progress, for example, in patients with HER2 positive breast cancer. But with the new treatments that are coming through, there are new subgroups emerging. One of the subgroups is obviously patients with HER2 low or low HER2 expression, and patients with ultra low HER2 expression. Now, the clinical treatments that made us look into different strategies are largely based around antibody drug conjugates. And if you look at the second generation of antibody drug conjugates we used in breast cancer, and T-DM1 is one of the examples, they required for their efficacy to have a relatively high and relatively homogeneous target expression. And that's why previously, when we used antibody drug conjugates, we had to have high target expression, for example, using HER2 targeting ADCs in HER2 positive breast cancer. But we've learned with the third generation of antibody drug conjugates that they actually also work in patients with lower and with heterogeneous target expression, and even in what we call ultra low expression, so very, very low, very few positive target positive cells, as you can see in this light blue compared to the pink target negative cells, may be enough for that treatment to give patients a treatment benefit. One of the questions that's still open is does the pattern of the expression really impact on how patients may respond? And there are interesting data coming through where it seems to be relevant, the distance between positive cells. For example, if you, as you can see on the right side of the slide, if you have clusters of positive cells, but surrounded largely by areas of negative cells, those patients may possibly respond less well to an antibody drug conjugate with a bystander effect compared to situations where the positive and negative cells are relatively mixed. Now, if you apply this principle of antibody drug conjugates and target expression to HER2 positive, that we come to the situation where we are now, that we really have to redefine how we look at HER2 positivity. Now, historically, we divided patients into two big groups. We had a big group of patients who were classified as HER2 positive, and those were patients who had a benefit from trastuzumab therapy. So trastuzumab targeting an oncogenic driver in this situation. And those were patients with high expression of HER2 by immune histochemistry, or sort of moderate expression of HER2 and an amplification of the gene. And all other patients did not really derive a benefit from trastuzumab, from HER2 targeted therapy with a monoclonal antibody at that time. But there, of course, that group of HER2 negative patients includes a large group of patients who have some expression of HER2, low expression of HER2, and then includes a group of patients who have no expression of HER2. And what we've learned is from very early data, and we'll see the clinical data a little bit later, that even in low expression of HER2, with a third generation antibody drug conjugate such as trastuzumab deruxtecan, we saw suddenly activity. We saw substantial tumor reduction in tumor size. And that is probably about 2/3 of patients with ER-positive breast cancer classified as HER2 low, and up to 1/3 of patients with triple negative breast cancer. Interestingly, some of the early data showed that even in patients who were classified at that time as HER2 zero, there could be a benefit from treatment with a drug such as trastuzumab deruxtecan. And what we are learning, and that's clinically really important, is low HER2 expression can change very quickly, can change in over time, but also can be quite heterogeneous. So if you take 3 or 4 different biopsies in the same patient at the same time, you may get different HER2 results, because if you're not looking at genetically imprinted or overexpressed HER2 expression, it will vary relatively quickly. And that's clinically relevant if you want to select patients for HER2-targeted therapy in the HER2-low space. So HER2-low is a new therapeutic subgroup, but in my opinion, not a biological subgroup, because HER2 is in this group of patients, not the oncogenic driver. And we came up defining this subgroup based around the observation that the new antibody drug conjugates, which release the payload, even in patients who have a relatively low expression, show a benefit in these HER2 low patients. Now, the classification, if you look at it in more detail, HER2 low includes group of IHC 2 plus and is negative, and IHC 1 plus. And if you look at the slide in front of you, that IHC 2 plus means in patients with a weak to moderate but complete membrane staining in 10% or more of the more than 10% of tumor cells, whereas IHC 1 plus is faint or incomplete membrane staining in at least 10% of tumor cells. And this is probably 2/3 of patients with a hormone receptor positive and classically HER2 negative breast cancer. But there's another group which is classified here as HER2 ultra low. And this is essentially a group of patients who have faint or incomplete membrane staining in less than 10% of tumor cells. And you will see in the clinical data later on that these patients are now also deriving a clinical benefit from HER2 targeted therapy. Now, this is a slide I borrowed from Beppe Viale, pathologist from Milano. And I think it's really important to picture this. A normal breast cancer cell can contain up to 20,000 HER2 molecules per cell. So it's never really, we don't really have true sero. Sero comes down to the antibody we use and how the antibody is optimized. Now, the current immune histochemistry assay are really titrated to avoid staining of normal cells. So normal cells, which still have some HER2 molecules, should come out as relatively negative. But it is clear that if you have a drug that doesn't need overexpression of the target, even those normal cells, which still have HER2 target, may be targets for HER2-targeted therapy. And the way we are reporting HER2 as a result is also being amended. If you look at the ESMO or the ASCO guidelines, it used to be positive versus negative, but reflecting that we are now using HER2 target antibody drug conjugates in patients with IHC 1 plus or 2 plus, we should now either use the term a HER2 low, which is not really a medically accurate, but better to classify patients by 0, 0 plus, 1 plus, or 2+, which allows the clinician to say whether this patient may be a candidate for HER2-directed antibody drug therapy. And if you look at the evolution of HER2-targeted therapy in breast cancer, it all started obviously with giving HER2-targeted therapy in patients who were classified as HER2-positive, with HER2 where HER2 was the oncogenic driver, then moved to patients who were classified as HER2 low, where HER2 is no longer the oncogenic driver. But we are now moving and increasingly moving to patients who have very low HER2 expression. But again, the very low HER2 expression is obviously just a snapshot at a certain point in time. So if you go back to HER2 testing, the challenges are there are obviously different antibodies and different detection systems. But what we mustn't forget, these were all initially optimized for HER2 high disease. They're optimized to tell us who are patients who have HER2 as an oncogenic driver. There are different platforms in use again for HER2 high disease, a different scoring system. There is, as we mentioned before, a substantial spatial and temporal heterogeneity. And this may just require that we repeat biopsies or take biopsies from different areas. But also the definition of 1+ score is not unequivocal, and there's still some form of discussion. The open questions for now is, will different antibodies, will different platforms or different assays be suitable as well, because obviously what worked well for HER2 high may be different for HER2 low. We may have to think about optimizing this for patients in clinical trials. Is there any correlation between the magnitude of the benefit and percentage of immune stained cells? And my gut feeling would be that the higher the expression is, that probably the more benefit we might see, but this is difficult to capture, obviously, in clinical trials. And the final question for us, and really for us to discuss, should we, and as Pepe would say, obsessively search for just one immune-stained cell among thousands of tumor cells? Is that enough for us to say we give her to targeted therapy with antibody drug conjugates? So as we have new medications, our classifications change, and for HER2 low breast cancer, that is clearly a new biological subgroup that has emerged, where we have still some open questions, but they will be answered with the drugs continuing to move forward.
So before you get into your cases, I want to give Mark and Joyce a chance to throw out some questions for your group to discuss. But I actually would like to start with one, and I want to direct this to Peter, because when you showed your slide about the normal cell, I remember that at the past San Antonio meeting, we had Dr. Sirigliano in one of our programs, and he was talking about HER2 normal, or that there's normally HER2 in the normal cell. And I was thinking, like, you know, for example, TROP2 and sacituzumab, we just go, oh, okay, all the cells have TROP2, so we're going to give it to everybody. So if you're saying that a normal breast cell has HER2 in it, then, like, if there really is a HER2-0, that would be, like, abnormal, you know, like, you would expect them to have HER2. So why not give a drug like TDXD, like you do with sacituzumab, to everybody?
And I think that's a really good question, and a lot of people are saying that is maybe what we should do over time, especially if our test systems aren't really there to say this is clearly HER2-0, because HER2-0 by definition doesn't exist. It's just as a result of a test that's optimized to detect obviously higher levels of HER2. Now I would just take this one step further. If we look at where we've come from. Targeted therapy, looking at an oncogenic driver with HER2 positive breast cancer. And then we are at the moment in a situation where we've developed a number of antibody drug conjugates that have a substantial bystander effect and therefore work in tumors with low expression and heterogeneous expression. And so we can, as you quite rightly say, probably use these ADCs in some patients who are classified as HER2-0 as well. But if you think one step ahead, what is limiting the activity of sequential ADC therapy at the moment, whether it's HER2 targeting, CHOP2 targeting, HER3 targeting, or so on, is the effect of the payload. And more tumors will develop resistance to the payload. So if we essentially often have one shot on goal with the best possible ADCs, because then the tumor cell may develop resistance to the payload. We may have in the future have to think about which of the ADCs we choose and going back to target expression. If you have a patient with very, very low HER2 expression, but relatively high CHOP2 expression, you know how you have an ADC that has the same payload, one targeting CHOP2, one targeting HER2, which one would you choose in that patient? And these studies obviously haven't been done, but I think that the degree of target expression might become more relevant in the future again. At the moment, it's probably less.
So, Mark, actually, we did a webinar this past week on triple-negative breast cancer, and I showed a whole bunch of slides from an education session that was done at San Antonio just in December on ADCs and breast cancer. It was incredible, and I learned so much from it. But I'm curious how you view this issue and some of the things that Peter brought up. And again, this question of is there really a HER2-0 patient? I remember I did a video with you and you were talking about patritumab and you were just saying, look, you just need to have some HER3 there for the thing to hang on to. What's your vision of how ADCs work in general, how TDXD works, and how we should, you know, sort of look at HER2 ultra low?
So those are excellent questions. You know, if you talk to Dennis Slamon, who invented this immunohistochemistry 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus scale in his 1989 science publication, he will tell you that there's no such thing as HER2 zero. In their paper, all the samples they analyzed were done with frozen tissue IHCs. So there's no fixation artifact. In normal pathology laboratories and hospitals across the world, the first thing they do with tumor tissue is fix it in formaldehyde, which is a great protein denaturing agent. And so you're losing some of the antigen you're trying to detect right off the bat. Whereas if you just would have frozen it to fix the tissue and do immunohistochemistry directly on the frozen tissue, you would find HER2 in all breast cancers. So he says there's no such thing as HER2 truly zero breast cancer. So that begs the question, you know, do these cases that we're now currently calling zero in our current generation of diagnostic assays, which were never devised to detect these very low levels in the first place, is there a clinically meaningful response to the TDXD with HER2 zero? There seems to be with HER2 ultra low already. And that begs the next question is, well, what about the ones that we're calling zero? Do they have enough of an efficacy signal to be of clinical interest? In which case, we may not need to measure HER2 and not worry about it much. We will know that there's a dose response with regard to the expression of the target. But if the absolute zero that we're calling currently still has an interesting clinical efficacy signal that's, clinically important, we may not need to measure it. We could just treat everybody and follow them closely and work that way. The question I have for Peter, though, is this question of currently practicing docs in the community. They get their charts. They're looking to identify patients who might benefit from antibody drug conjugate trastuzumab drug scan. And all they see is HER2 positive and HER2 negative, the legacy testing results from back in the day. So then they have to dig up the immunohistochemistry report itself to see if it's 1 plus or 2 plus, which is the current definition of low, if it's ish or fish negative. But when I talked to pathologists at the American College of Pathology meeting 2 years ago, when they heard we're going to start digging up these legacy zero versus one plus calls that they made back in the day prior to the advent of TDXD, they were horrified because they freely admitted they never spent any time trying to discriminate between those two. So the first principle for practicing clinicians is you really should retest. And as you mentioned, that retesting should probably be on the most recent sample, since the HER2 levels can be dynamic. It's probably best to get the first biopsy of the first metastasis, which in many cases is the most recent biopsy available for testing. So that's the second lesson I think that's important for clinicians to use now. And then the third is to realize that on serial retesting, you will get different results because of the high discordance rate between pathologists reading the same samples. And I'll talk about that during my presentation. So what are your thoughts about that, Peter? How do you deal with that at your institution in terms of deciding which sample to test?
Yeah, Mark, it's an important question. So first of all, all the old reports were obviously only looking at HER2 high, and anything that wasn't HER2 high was irrelevant. If it happens to tell us that there was low expression of HER2, that's good enough for me as a clinician. So I may be the outlier here, but I'm looking for reasons to use the drug rather than not use the drug. And so if I have any justification that I can use trastuzumab deruxtecan in a patient who has had some low HER2 expression over time, I'm very happy to do so. So if the old report already says there's some HER2 expression, fine. If it just says HER2 negative, that means absolutely nothing, as you quite rightly say. And then it comes down to retesting. Now, I'm not entirely sure I would necessarily always go for the most recent tissue, because I don't think it is an evolutionary process. I think it's more a random process going up and down over time. It's different to, for example, how the estrogen receptor evolves over time and gradually may disappear. I think the HER2 expression can change within 5 minutes. And if you put your biopsy needle a little bit right or left, it will also go up or down. And therefore, I would always look at, in a pragmatic way, how can I get my hand on as many tissue samples as possible until I find one of the tissue samples that is, in theory, positive and allows me to give trastuzumab deruxtecan to patients. That's my personal bias, but I think the data we have don't say it has to be the most recent biopsy. The data says if any biopsy in the past showed low expression of HER2, patients likely have a chance of deriving a benefit from HER2-targeted therapy in this setting, and that would be my clinical strategy.
Joyce, are you doing the same thing, retesting all samples?
No, I don't go back and retest samples. Actually, I will rebiopsy. What I wanted to ask you guys is, what if you've had a couple of metastatic biopsies and they're red as zero. They're really red as zero, not just HER2 negative, but they're red as zero. But you go back through the chart, as Peter was just alluding to, and find a 1+, you know, from the original breast cancer diagnosis. Do you feel like we're on firm ground to go ahead and offer the patient the T-DXd?
So I personally would do. The only patients where I wouldn't consider it at the moment is if they're consistently through all biopsies always zero, but if at least one of the biopsies at any point in time showed some positivity, that's for me enough justification to use the drug.
So let's move on and talk about Peter's cases. Peter, if you could briefly present this first case and just put out to your colleagues maybe a question in terms of maybe how they would manage a patient like this or what their thoughts are about what you did.
Yeah, thank you. So this is a 56-year-old a lady who was treated in a hospital without a pathogenic germline mutation, who initially presented in 2015 with a locally advanced and node positive breast cancer, ear positive. And then, as you can see, low expression of HER2. She received neoadjuvant anthracycline taxane-based chemotherapy. Had a reasonable response, but obviously had residual disease at surgery in breast and lymph nodes. That residual disease was HER2 zero. She received adjuvant endocrine therapy with letrozole. And then within 3 years, just over 3 years, from starting endocrine therapy, she unfortunately had metastatic disease recurrence in liver, bone, lymph nodes, was re-biopsied, and again was ER positive and HER2 zero. She received fulvestrant and ribociclib as an AI resistant a patient, and on progression had a genomic testing and was ESR and PIK3CA wild type. We tried at that time to give eximest and everolimus as a second-line endocrine therapy, but it was clear she was progressing relatively quickly. So progressive disease, first-line chemotherapy, paclitaxel, had a reasonable benefit, developed small number of brain mets, and then progression in liver and peritoneum after around 6 months. And we treated the brain mets with gamma knife therapy. And the question really here is, what would you do in this situation? And that's a little bit where we were just with the discussion, Joyce and Mark. Would you re-biopsy in this situation? Would you give capecitabine? Would you give T-DXd? Or would you give sacituzumab govitecan? And our thoughts at this point in time was this patient had at some point low expression of HER2, and that was in the primary tumor, admittedly, although the last two biopsies showed IHC zero. We decided to move ahead with T-DXd, and she derived a good response for quite a few months before she then developed further disease progression. And it is, I think this is pretty much the situation we discussed a minute ago, is do you choose a different strategy? Would you have done another biopsy in this situation? Or is it enough information to have one historic sample that shows low expression for HER2? And for me personally, in that situation, there was, and it happened to work out for this patient.
So Joyce, everybody has a different kind of philosophy about how they approach metastatic breast cancer. When you look at this case, any thoughts, as Peter was presenting the case, any thoughts come to your mind in terms of how you might have managed this case and what you would be thinking about now?
Yeah, she's got really aggressive disease. She was grade 3 there to start off with and just had 3 years on the letrozole. And then when she progressed on the paclitaxel, now it's in the peritoneum, it's in the brain. It's a pretty aggressive breast cancer. So I would definitely want to give her the very best thing I had at that point. Sometimes these patients, they can just change on you and they obstruct in their peritoneum. They obstruct their small bowel and you can't treat them anymore. So I'm definitely looking for my very best therapy. But I'm considering the sacituzumab versus the TDXD here because her most recent biopsy was 0. And we just are left with this question. Is the amount of target you have going to really dictate how well, deeply, and durably you respond, you know? Because she has brain mets, I would probably lean towards the TDXD. You know, she's already been biopsied once, and, you know, I just don't think that our diagnostics at the IHC level are really good enough for me to really distinguish between 0 and 1+. We know there's a spectrum in there. It depends on how hard the pathologists look, et cetera. And there's all kind of, you know, pre-analytic variables, et cetera. It's just so heterogeneous, as we said. If we get an area, then the other right next to it is positive, et cetera. So I probably would not re-biopsy. I do get serial CT DNAs on these patients, as was done here, looking for ESR1 and PIK3CA. So I do that. That's not going to help us from a expression of HER2 situation. Although I am aware that we're going to be getting more access to circulating tumor cells, CTCs. So CTCs are going to be coming back here, and that's going to be interesting to us. And we'll be able to look at the protein expression of HER2. I think that's actually going to be very interesting. So I would have debated between the sacituzumab and the TDXD in this patient, but ultimately I would have probably leaned towards the TDXD because of her brain mets, albeit treated brain mets, but still she's vulnerable to developing more brain mets.
But it's interesting what you say, Charles. I totally agree, obviously, with what you say. But for one drug, we are sticking to the result of a test. Or for the other drug that has a similar concept, we don't even test. And so I think what we're doing at the moment in medicine is sometimes a little bit, if you excuse the word, schizophrenic, because for TROP2, we are not testing at all. And we know there's very low and there's sometimes zero expression. For HER2, we are testing. And therefore, I think we just need to be pragmatic, as you describe. And the other consideration for me is also that maybe a little bit of a European view. We are slightly more restricted in the use of treatments depending on the lines that were initially investigated. So it's more difficult for us to give TDXT in later lines, whereas we can give sacituzumab in slightly. So from an ER-positive view, our sequence is more often TDXT followed by sacituzumab. That is obviously different in triple-negative breast cancer.
Mark, anything you want to add to this?
Well, this case is over the plate for the current FDA label language, which is based on the DESTINY-Breast04 data, which is level one evidence of a PFS and OS benefit favoring TDXD over chemo du jour control in that trial. That plus the fast pace of this disease, I would probably be loath to move on to something like capecitabine in this case with visceral and brain disease. So I think going with the most active drug class that you've got with TDXD makes a lot of sense. And it matches the label language of patients who have had prior endocrine therapy and one prior chemotherapy for their metastatic disease. And the 1+ being in two different specimens, the biopsy specimen and in the surgical specimen, is somewhat reassuring to me, despite the more recent negative IHC 0 results. But based on the label, those would be acceptable to enable use of TDXD. I'd probably make that a highlight of the progress note so that payers wouldn't get hung up on the more recent IHC 0 results.
Interesting. All right, Peter, how about the 62-year-old woman?
Yeah, so the second case is I chose because it highlights a a question that might become more clinically relevant as we move forward in the years to come. So again, this was a patient who at high risk early disease, adjuvant therapy, letrozole. This time the patient stayed on treatment for 5 years and actually had a treatment-free interval as well, had relatively late metastatic disease recurrence, relatively low risk at that time with bone mets, and was considered as an AI-sensitive patient, therefore treated with letrozole and ribociclib. But disappointingly, this patient had disease progression, quite aggressive disease progression, within a short period of time, liver, lung, lymph nodes, and stayed on first-line combination endocrine therapy for less than 8 months. She had a mutational testing on cfDNA. It wasn't found to have an ESR1 or PIK3CA mutation. And this is a patient where we normally would obviously, in the past, would have always said, try more endocrine therapy. But here the question is just, what would you do? Do we re-biopsy? We obviously already had the liquid biopsy. Do we give further endocrine therapy? If so, that it would be something fulvestrant-based, I would assume, although our temptation would be then to give something fulvestrant. And for example, everolimus, she hasn't got a PIK3CA mutation, so it doesn't classify whether of the PI3K or AKT inhibitors. Or is this a patient where we move on to chemotherapy at that stage? And is this a patient where we would possibly even consider a TDXD or an ADC that early in that setting? And I just wanted to put that out because we I think where we are heading a little bit was we are getting better at using the full endocrine potential in patients, but we're also possibly getting better in identifying patients who may not benefit from several lines from endocrine therapy. So is this a patient you would consider as despite only having had one line of endocrine therapy, as hormone refractory? And as such, with quite aggressive disease, would you consider in this patient, possibly with low HER2 expression, to give an antibody drug conjugate?
So Joyce, I'd like you to comment on your thinking about this kind of situation, but because we've seen more and more data trying to figure out who's quote endocrine sensitive, and like one of the ways I've seen is how long they're on endocrine therapy. Can you just remind us how long the patient was on the letrozole and ribo before she progressed?
So we should just under 8 months. So she progressed within
8 months.
Month seven, she progressed. Yes.
And what's the HER2 status?
1+.
So on the original biopsy, she was 1+, and she was bone only when she recurred. So it looks like that wasn't biopsied at the time. But now she's got liver metastasis. I probably would re-biopsy her liver metastasis and get enough tissue for full NGS. That'd be my main reason. If I have a 1+ for the HER2 in hand, I'm happy about that opportunity for the patient. But I still would re-biopsy the liver. I'd want to look at the estrogen receptor again for this patient. This patient, if she's basically asymptomatic-ish and her liver function is good, this is a patient I would consider fulvestrant and abemaciclib. Or I've had a number of patients where I start with ribociclib and letrozole and they don't benefit or don't benefit very long. They may benefit like somewhat and then they progress. And I've had a number of patients do well with fulvestrant and abemaciclib. We saw that in a subset of patients in the post-MONARCH trial. So that would be a consideration in my mind. I have not had good luck with everolimus in this kind of more endocrine therapy resistant type disease. So that would not be something I'd be interested in. Another consideration would be capecitabine. Again, she'd have to be pretty asymptomatic and the liver function tests would have to be good. She doesn't exactly fit the ESMO definition of primary endocrine therapy resistant, neither in the adjuvant setting where she got her full 5 years, nor did she quite progress within that 6 months. It's pretty close though. I mean, it's pretty close. So those would be the things I would be considering, fulvestrant, abemaciclib versus capecitabine. We don't have the FDA approval or NCCN endorsement of first-line TDXD yet. I think in the future, that would be coming. And if a woman is really having a very substantial symptomatic progression or beginning to really impinge on organ function, I think in the future that will be an option for the patient, but it isn't really yet in the U.S. an option. We don't have that first line approval yet. So generally speaking, I'd stick with another line of endocrine therapy. It would be probably fulvestrant and abemaciclib if she was, like I said, not that symptomatic, her end organ function is good. I have had good luck with capecitabine working after abemaciclib. So I usually postpone the initiation of IV therapy. But I would get another biopsy. And regardless, even if the HER2 is zero, because we'd have a 1+ in hand, you know, from her original diagnosis, that would still give me the green light to offer her TDXD in the future.
So before we go on, because we're going to go to the next module in a second, Peter, what's the follow-up on this case? What actually happened?
So we weren't allowed to, as well with this patient, to give her TDXD at this point. We couldn't give up abemaciclib, and we decided to give her capecitabine. She progressed relatively quickly on capecitabine and is now on TDXD.
How's she doing on the TDXD, or too early to say?
It is too early to say, but so far things look stable.
So one final comment from Mark again about this case, also reflecting on Joyce's thoughts. I was curious if this sort of post-monarch of abemaciclib strategy, how you're using it. Do you look at how long they were on the CDK? Does it matter which CDK they were on, ribo or Palbo, and any other thoughts about this case, Mark?
Yeah, you know, if they start off with Palbo, it's quite a bit easier because then you have the maintained clinical trial where most of those patients started off on Palbo, and when switched to ribo, they had a, you know, improved PFS compared to control. So that's probably the most common scenario at our center where we're using CDK4/6 inhibitors in multiple lines. For this case, I probably would have gone with, if she was asymptomatic, had nominal liver function, I probably would have gone with a fulvestrant and everolimus based on the strength of the PRECOG 102 data, which showed an improved PFS in a randomized trial with that regimen. But I would do early interval restaging because I would be worried that she may progress rapidly through further endocrine therapy and then move quickly onto capecitabine if that was necessary. But I have no objection to moving straight to capecitabine, as it sounds like was done, especially if the size of the liver lesions were disconcerting, or if they were symptomatic, and same with the lung, if there were issues in terms of symptoms and concern for rapid progression that could impair organ function, then I would move on to chemotherapy quickly. And then I would save TDXD for after capecitabine to meet the label language currently that we have in the U.S., which again requires endocrine refractory plus one prior line of chemo. And that way you don't run into a problem with payers trying to get it in the first line after endocrine therapy.
So that's a really great case, Peter. One final question back to you, Peter. It sounds like there are a couple of regulatory issues preventing you from using TDXD, and also sounds like Abema post-monarch. If you had no regulatory issues at all, you could access whatever you want, what would you have likely done with this patient at that point after progressing on the ribo and letrozole?
So I think I was nervous in this patient to give her more endocrine therapy because she looked like a patient who should have endocrine-sensitive disease, and she did not have that. It had a very rapid disease progression within 7 months in an AI-sensitive patient with CDK4/6. That's, for me, a very poor prognostic factor. And without a mutation, I wouldn't have wanted to give her more endocrine therapy. So Abema wasn't something I would have liked to give. I would have preferred to give her TDXD at that time, because I was a little bit worried about the volume of her disease and would have liked to have a treatment that has the maximum response rate. And the response rates are higher with TDXD compared to most other agents.
All right, so we're going to move on now. And Mark, you're going to review expanding the spectrum of targetability and practical application of HER2-targeted therapy.
Thanks, Neil. And I think this presentation will reflect on both of these cases that we just discussed. So perfect timing. This is the presentation now. Outline, we'll talk about rationale for the clinical activity observed with TDXD in patients with HER2-low and HER2-ultra-low breast cancer. We'll discuss long-term follow-up data from the phase 3 DESTINY-Breast04 study evaluating T-DXd versus chemo for patients with previously treated HER2-low advanced cancer. We'll discuss recently presented results from the phase 3 DESTINY-Breast06 trial demonstrating a statistically significant progression-free survival advantage with the use of T-DXd in patients with hormone receptor-positive HER2-low or HER2-ultra-low metastatic breast cancer following one or more lines of endocrine therapy. And finally, we'll talk about clinical activity reported with T-DXd in patients with HER2-low breast cancer with brain metastasis. So this is my, homage to antibody-drug conjugates. They're acting kind of like a Trojan horse, bringing a cytotoxic payload to gain access to the intracellular space and then kill from within. And this, of course, is in Greek on the right-hand side of the slide, written in Greek, is the Odyssey, where Homer describes the siege of Troy and the Trojan horse approach in Greek mythology. When you talk to pathologists about identifying HER2-low, there's a lot of discordance between pathologists and between biopsies trying to distinguish this IHC0 versus IHC1 plus status. And in this particular study, there's a 27% discordance rate. And so that's really disconcerting to me, because if the level of expression is indeed important, I think we owe it to our patients to come up with a more sensitive assay that was designed deliberately to look at this question critically rather than rely on the legacy assays that we're using still to this day, which were designed to detect high-level HER2 overexpression, usually as a consequence of gene amplification. So I think our patients deserve more, and if the distinction between 0 and 1 plus is clinically meaningful, and I think that may be questionable still to this day, then we need to move on to more sensitive assays to make that determination with more reliability. By the way, if the discordance rate between 0 and 1 plus is 27%, imagine what it would be between 0 and HER2 ultra low. It would be even higher. This is Dennis Slamon's science paper from 1989 that I already discussed, showing that even in their HER2 zero cases, as you can see on the IHC on the lower left, there was some immunostaining even in that IHC zero in the frozen state. These are frozen IHC samples on the lower left-hand side of the slide. And you can read in the quote that they, describe this as negative to weak in the zero cases. And that's kind of analogous to the ultra-low situation that's described in the modern era in DESTINY-Breast06. Now, this is data looking at this issue of dose of HER2 in the DAISY trial. There were three cohorts. There was a HER2-positive cohort, which is either FISH-positive or IHC3+. That's the waterfall plot on the far left. And there was a cohort 2, which was HER2-low. That's IHC1+ or 2+ and ISH-negative. And then there was this cohort 1, which was HER2 and ISH flat-out negative. But if you do the statistics, the summary is shown at the bottom. There was a statistically significant difference between these cohorts. And this was even more marked on the time to event analysis of the progression-free survival in these cohorts, where there was a significant distinction between the three different cohorts with regard to their level of HER2 expression, with the highest responses and longest PFS being in those with the highest level of HER2 expression. And it was on a continuum kind of basis for that time to event PFS endpoint. On the far left, you can see just the T-DXd molecule and how it has a cleavable linker chemistry, so it can release the payload even before it gets to the lysosome. And moreover, the payload is soluble as opposed to T-DM1, which has an insoluble payload, therefore can kill bystander HER2 negative cells in addition. So that's an advantage of this drug over other antibody drug conjugates targeting HER2. This is the DESTINY-Breast04 schema. These are patients who were HER2-low metastatic breast cancer, one or two prior lines of chemotherapy in the metastatic setting, all had prior endocrine therapy. This started off as a hormone receptor positive primary intent to treat population, and then later a small fraction of triple negative cases was added to this cohort as well. It's T-DXd versus treatment physician's choice with CAPE, eribulin, gemcitabine, paclitaxel, or nab-paclitaxel. Large study, adequately powered, well-controlled, good solid study design, in my opinion. This is a more recent update to the primary data that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine previously, again, showing an improvement of progression-free survival in the hormone receptor-positive cohort on the left and in the all-patient population on the right. And these continue to be highly statistically significant with longer follow-up. And indeed, there was an overall survival benefit published in the New England Journal paper with a hazard ratio of 0.64, where the median overall survival in the control arm was just 17 and a half months versus 23.9 months in the TDXD arm, for an improvement of about 6.5 months. And that was highly statistically significant. At ESMO this year, we saw a biomarker analysis with all of the factors listed at the bottom of this slide. And the bottom line is none of these factors that they evaluated were successful biomarkers for prediction of benefit in this HER2-low DESTINY-Breast04 population, unfortunately. So more work needs to be done in that regard if we're to more carefully be able to choose patients most likely to benefit from this approach. The FDA label language is on the far right. We've already talked about this, so I won't spend time on it. But it's basically for patients with one prior line of chemo after having progressed on prior endocrine therapy. In terms of DESTINY-Breast06, this is the TDXD randomized trial one line earlier, essentially, than DESTINY-Breast04. So this is first-line cytotoxic therapy following progression on all lines of endocrine therapy. That's the group that we're looking at in this trial. It included HER2-low and HER2-ultra-low. As Peter has already defined, that's some staining in less than 10% of the cells, but not truly zero. They were chemotherapy naive in the metastatic setting in this cohort, and I think that's important to point out. They were randomized to TDXD 5.4 mg per kg for 3 weeks, over 400 patients randomized to that group, and treatment resistance choice as shown with CAPE, nab-paclitaxel, or paclitaxel. The primary endpoint was PFS by blinded independent committee review in the HER2-low population. These are the top-line data shown on the upper left-hand side of the slide. The study was positive in the HER2-low population with a hazard ratio of 0.62, which is highly statistically significant. I should mention that there were immature overall survival data available with only about 35% of the needed events currently present. So that's going to need longer follow-up. So we do not yet have OS data for this cohort. Importantly, look at the bottom left of the slide. That's the quality of life measures that were presented from this trial at ESMO. And interestingly, despite there being numerically more toxicities in the TDXD arm, the quality of life measures that were studied in this paper by Hu and colleagues at ESMO, it seemed quite similar between the two treatment arms. The forest plot shows subgroup analysis of multiple clinical and pathologic subgroups available in this data set. I won't go through them all in the interest of time, but look at the consistency of the data. That's the most important finding. It's not as if just one particular niche subgroup is benefiting from this agent. It appears that everybody across the board is benefiting largely similarly. So I think that's an important outcome. Now, this is the HER2 ultra-low subset analysis, which was a pre-specified exploratory analysis, but only 152 patients. So this is a small subset. The hazard ratio for PFS in this group was 0.78, but with a wide 95% confidence interval from 0.5 to 1.21. But you can see the delta in PFS there compared to control of about 13 versus about 5 months. And then OS, similarly, there seemed to be a trend, hazard ratio 0.75. But as I mentioned, that's immature data and needs longer time for follow-up. The authors concluded there was PFS improvement with TDXD compared to chemo control in the HER2 ultra-low, which they viewed to be consistent with the results in the HER2-low population and the overall intent-to-treat population in the study of DESTINY-Breast06. Of 349 patients that were scored as HER2-IHC0 locally, 24% were centrally determined to be HER2-low, even though they were previously called zero, and 40% as ultra-low. So it may be advisable for patients with hormone receptor-positive HER2-IHC0 metastatic disease to be reassessed to determine TDXD eligibility. And that was the conclusion from Viali and colleagues at ESMO this year that Peter already mentioned their presentation previously. This is the safety data, and you can clearly see there is numerically more chemo-like side effects in the TDXD arm. Fortunately, most of these are low-grade, but some of them are significant, so you need to you know, talk to patients about the treatment options and what to expect in terms of toxicity. Fortunately, most of these are highly manageable since we do this with chemotherapy on a daily basis in clinical practice anyway. So none of these are necessarily deal breakers. I will point out that there were 3 grade 5 ILD cases in this particular clinical trial. And so one must be mindful of the risk of ILD in this population. So if you look at the ultra low definition, it may add theoretically up to another 20-25% of patients that might be considered as candidates for HER2 antibody drug conjugate therapy with T-DXd in the future. The authors conclude that in DB06, T-DXd demonstrated a statistically significant and clinically meaningful PFS benefit in the HER2 low group and similar results in the exploratory subset of the ultra low. There are caveats. The exploratory efficacy signals in DB06, while interesting, come at the cost of higher toxicities, including grade 5 ILD. The OS data are still immature. For many patients, let's say they have a long natural history, they've been on endocrine therapy perhaps for years. For some of those patients, capecitabine may still rightly be used as a bridge into the cytotoxic class of ADCs and chemo, in my opinion. So it's important to do a balanced discussion with such patients and let them weigh in on these decisions. We now have data from the clinic looking at various risk factors for ILD. I think that's very important. Until recently, we didn't have this kind of granularity in terms of patient selection. So it's important to look at perhaps renal function, prior history of pulmonary disease, and other factors in order to best select and monitor for ILD in these T-DXd-treated patients to try to avoid the grade 5 situation at all costs. On the left, you can see the kinetics of the ILD showing that it's mostly in the first year or so, but not exclusively, but mostly in the first year. Recently, we saw an update to this DB06 data presented at San Antonio, where investigators looked at patients' prior treatment with CDK4/6 inhibitors with endocrine therapy and whether they had rapid progression within 6 months of that treatment, 6 to 12 months, or greater than 12 months. And ironically, it looked like there was greater separations at the median in the PFS curves for the rapid progressors. So certainly no downside to moving quickly to an antibody drug conjugate if you have rapid progression while on endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 inhibitor. So I thought that was quite interesting. And the same message was shown for the objective response rate and also response duration. So there's no downside if you have rapid progressors on endocrine therapy to move to this strategy early. Moreover, one criticism to the DB06 data had been, well, maybe you're just going to get all these responders to T-DXd in the first line, but then you'll have chemo refractory disease from then on. And so PFS2 was tracked in a fraction of these patients in DB06 to look and see how they responded to whatever treatment they were assigned to in their clinical practice after they went off study and completed their T-DXd treatment. And it looks like T-DXd did not interfere with response to chemotherapy in the following line, and there is still a benefit in PFS2 in those patients. And that's reassuring that they're not using up all of their efficacy with the T-DXd to the exclusion of benefit for follow-on salvage therapy. So that's reassuring. In conclusion, future directions for this agent, in addition to earlier stage treatment in metastatic disease, may be further clinical investigation in early stage breast cancer. This is a HER2 low trial that was done in the neoadjuvant setting presented by Sarah Hurvitz and Aditya Bardia previously. This was just a small randomized pilot phase 2 trial looking at T-DXd versus T-DXd plus anastrozole as neoadjuvant therapy. Fortunately, the regimens were very well tolerated, no grade 5 ILD. So feasibility of this approach, I believe, was demonstrated, although the response rates are arguably a little bit less in the combination arm compared to the single agent T-DXd. But it establishes precedent that we may want to look at this agent in early breast cancer in the future. Other novel combination studies include this DB08 trial, again, looking at various combinations with other endocrine agents, again, anastrozole, and also with fulvestrin, shown on the waterfall plots on the right-hand side of the slide. Again, small numbers, pilot data, just establishing proof of concept and feasibility in terms of safety, that this is something that could be considered in the future if needed in earlier lines of treatment, including maybe early stage disease. Finally, this is the limited data we have available for response to HER2 low brain metastasis on treatment with T-DXd. And it looks like, again, even though small numbers in pilot data, the intracranial best response rate rivals that of the extracranial best response rate on the right-hand side of the slide, suggesting that these antibody-drug conjugates can and do get into the CNS and are able to have an efficacy signal in HER2-low brain metastasis, in addition to the HER2-positive brain metastasis updates that we've seen recently as well. So all that's very reassuring.
So I want to go to Peter and Joyce before we get to your cases. And Joyce, I want to start with you and ask you, based on what you've seen in HER2 ultra low, what are you thinking in terms of utilizing that strategy? And the other issue is, theoretically, would you like to be able to use the strategy? Are you using the strategy? And then one of the big questions I have is, I can understand that it might have been difficult to try to go for hormone receptor negative ultra low, but it doesn't look to me like they were in the study. So do you think we can just use all the data from all the other studies to say it doesn't really matter whether they're hormone receptor positive or not, or you would pull out just the ER positives?
You know, we have still relatively little data in triple negative breast cancer with TDXD. In DB04, we had 58 patients treated or randomized, I think, and it looked very good. It looked very good, but then we don't have any data in HER2 ultra low or in the first line setting. And meanwhile, we have the, you know, kind of very rapidly progressing development of targeting TROP2 in the triple negative breast cancer patients. And as we talked about before, I think we're going to have to take our best shot on goal with these agents that have topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payload. So I think that if a triple negative breast cancer is HER2 low, we've seen data from DB04. I'm comfortable there with TDXD, but ultra low, I'm really not at this point. It's just to have like 1% of cells positive and a triple negative where I know there's tremendous heterogeneity of disease. I just don't have a comfort level. Not when I have sacituzumab and soon to have, I hope, datopotamab for those patients. So that's my sense of things for triple negative. I would go more with the sacituzumab, even if they were HER2 ultra low. HER2 low, I'm more comfortable with TDXD, but I still would prioritize a TROP2 directed therapy. However, in the HR positive patients in DB06, my interpretation of the ultra low data is that they're identical to the HER2 low population, both with regard to PFS, but also the response rates. You couldn't get them more identical with the HER2 ultra low than the HER2 low. So very, very impressive data. And there I'm very comfortable with the HER2 ultra low. And I think ultimately that's what we're doing in practice today with our HR positive patients. We have a historical 1+ from 10 years ago on the primary, and we have nothing but 0 in the metastatic setting, but we're treating the patient anyway. We're probably treating some ultra low disease there, and it's really, really quite effective, as we've seen in DB04 in particular, when they went back and they looked at response to TDXD based on a historical primary HER2 low result versus a metastatic HER2 low result. There wasn't any difference in terms of the benefit from the TDXD. So I think we're kind of de facto treating HER2 ultra low in practice. Now I'm very comfortable with that in the HR positive patients.
Joyce, do you think that the DB06 data will be sufficient for an FDA label expansion, given that it's defined in the protocol as an exploratory subset analysis? The 95% confidence limit of the PFS hazard ratio overlapped 1. There's a lot of interesting things here. No statistics were applied, rightly so, I think, for an exploratory endpoint. So there was no p-value assigned to the DB06 ultra-low cohort. Is that going to be okay, just to, since it's a label expansion and not a new drug indication? Do you think the regulators will look at that favorably, or do we need to wait for the OS data, for example, and wait for more robust statistics?
I'll just, of course, give you my opinion. Because the study was strongly positive for its primary endpoint, I think that my guess would be the FDA will approve it for the intent to treat population, including the ultra low, because the data looked quite strong there. I think the issue that I think we as clinicians face and the FDA faces as well is that we have a very strong survival signal in the second line setting. And the question is, in the DB06, what percentage of the patients on the control arm got later a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payload ADC? Because right now it's very early. The data are very immature in terms of survival, but we don't see a signal yet on survival in the first line setting. So one could argue to use a cytotoxic such as capecitabine first and then give the T-DXd in the second line setting. But there are patients that we want to give the very best drug first to because they have aggressive, heavy tumor burden. And so I've not seen that data yet, how many patients in the control arm on DB06 got, you know, a switch, a crossover to an agent that would make survival curves not split, you know, initially. But, you know, there's no reason, honestly, of course, that the survival impact of T-DXd in the first line setting should be any different than in the second line setting. I would expect at the end of the day, we're going to see a nice survival improvement in the overall treated population. But I think that's a question for the FDA and for us at this time.
Very insightful.
So, Peter, I want to give you a chance, Peter, to comment on this. And, you know, also, I think the issue is not whether or not you can use T-DXd and, you know, ultra low, for example, but sort of when. As Joyce was saying, like, what's going to come first, particularly if you have a patient where you really want to see a response. I mean, you may want to use T-DXd later also. Peter, any thoughts about this discussion that's going back and forth between Mark and Joyce about this?
Yeah. You're thinking. It's very clear that T-DXd is a superior strategy, a superior drug compared to the standard chemotherapy agents. That doesn't necessarily mean we have to use it always as a first-line therapy. What I find interesting is that the delta between the experimental arm, so T-DXd, and the control arm is relatively similar in the first and in the second and subsequent line setting. In other words, if you just put the data from the two trials together and sequentially, you come to a relatively similar time point as long as patients receive T-DXd. One of the key strengths for me, and we haven't spoken much about that so far, is the response rates. And I know response sounds like a very old-fashioned endpoint, but response is a really important endpoint if you have patients with aggressive disease and if you have patients with symptomatic disease. And in that situation where you need to achieve the maximum response, T-DXd or other ADCs are clearly better than our conventional chemotherapy. So to answer your question around the sequencing, if a patient has very aggressive and symptomatic disease and where we're not quite sure whether we get two shots on goal if the first shot misses, that is a clear situation where I would like to use T-DX in a first line setting. But in many patients, that's not the case. In many patients, we can very well treat those patients with a taxane or with capecitabine as an orally available treatment. And then T-DXd will still have that high efficacy and activity in a second line setting. And I think we will just have to define this by clinical parameters where the superior response rate is really going to give patients the maximum benefit. It's interesting if you look at the quality of life data of the study, which are relatively similar. If you look at some of the quality of life data of other ADCs and other indications, we sometimes see superiority with the ADC. And that's, again, more in later lines and more in patients who have higher disease burden. What I find very interesting is sometimes the quality of life benefit is almost transferred into the next line of therapy. Because if you start your disease, your line with a disease burden here, you reset that disease burden with a superior response. Even at the time of progression, patients may have a lower disease burden, and that can lead to a symptomatic benefit. So it's a long-winded answer, but I think we need to select the right patients for the right treatment at the right time. And not everyone at this point in time requires the most aggressive therapy or the most effective therapy in the first-line setting. There's still a role for some patients for chemotherapy.
I was going to mention before in terms of these studies where you look at quality of life that it's always a little confusing to me because you're mixing in quality of life issues that come from reducing the tumor burden, as you just said, if a patient is symptomatic, But then on top of that, you have the toxicity burden, which affects quality of life. And I think one of the things about that is I think as time goes on and people are better able to manage side effects of TDXD, particularly GI side effects, which I find even now, I'm not sure everybody is quite exactly on top of. You would expect maybe that's going to actually improve. But anyhow, let's get into these cases here. Mark, you have a 62-year-old woman. What happened?
She presented with a palpable right upper outer quadrant mass measuring about 6 centimeters. No prior history or family history, ECOG zero. Because of the size and clinical stage of her disease presentation, she had full-on staging with a body imaging with a CT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, as well as a bone scan. The CT of the chest showed 2 pulmonary nodules, the largest of which was 0.8 centimeters. In hindsight, the patient notes that she had a persistent cough for about a month prior to diagnosis, but she had attributed that to a prior bout of COVID-19 infection. The bone scan was negative. The breast primary biopsy showed a grade 2 infiltrating ductal carcinoma, HER2 IHC 1+ by immunohistochemistry. FISH was not amplified. A fine needle aspirate of the lung nodule showed an adenocarcinoma consistent with the breast primary and similar markers to the primary tumor. So on staging, she had M1 disease.
Before you go on, at that point when you were evaluating her, what were you thinking in terms of her pulmonary symptoms? Did you think it was explained by what you were seeing on imaging?
Probably not. I thought that probably it's most likely that it was still sequelae from her recent pneumonia and probably such a small 0.8 centimeter lesion or two would not be expected to cause pulmonary symptoms.
Do you ever see a subclinical, lymphangitic spread in the lung where, you don't really see imaging wise and patients actually start to have symptoms before you see an imaging, or usually by the time they're symptomatic, you'll see it on imaging?
Lymphangitic spread is often symptomatic early, and it often does show up radiographically early as well. So both are true for that particular pattern.
So let's continue with her case.
So she had first-line systemic therapy with an aromatase inhibitor and a CDK4/6 inhibitor. The denosumab was because she had osteoporosis, not because of bone metastasis. A partial response in the breast and lung were achieved as the best response on CDK4/6 inhibition. 32 months later, she had worsening non-productive cough and shortness of breath when climbing stairs, otherwise feeling well without bone pain, good appetite. Restaging, new and enlarging lung nodules, the largest now 2 centimeters. The bone scan showed new uptake in the thoracic spine and the ribs. ECOG had slipped from 0 to 1. Her hemoglobin A1C was normal. Peripheral blood specimens were sent for ctDNA profiling, and she had no targetable mutations on that assay in the PI3 kinase AKT pathway or in the ESR1 gene. So second line, she received fulvestrant, having no druggable mutations found. 3 months after initiating second line therapy, she had worsening bone pain, and progression of disease was confirmed. Third line therapy consists of exemestane and everolimus, through which she had rapid disease progression by both lung and bone imaging. Fourth line therapy consisted of capecitabine. Initial scan 12 weeks after initiation of capecitabine showed stable disease. And then 5 months later, an imaging study showed increasing bone pain, 2 new liver lesions, 1.2 to 1.1 centimeters in size. Lung disease was stable. LFTs were normal. Bone scan showed additional bone lesions consistent with disease progression on first-line chemotherapy with capecitabine. She then had famtrastuzumab deruxtecan as her next line of therapy. And this is just the label language showing that this is completely consistent with the current FDA approval for the HER2-low indication for TDXD, and that is to say following one line, or in this case the language reads, a prior chemotherapy in the metastatic setting or rapid disease progression after completion of adjuvant therapy.
So what's this patient's current situation?
She's had stable disease as the best response to trastuzumab deruxtecan. That lasted for a few to maybe several months, and then she progressed while on it. So she did not rise to the level of an objective PR in this case, but had stable disease, which I believe was meaningful, that lasted for a few months And so it was felt to be clinically meaningful, even in hindsight.
And again, getting back to this woman's pulmonary symptoms of cough and I guess some dyspnea on exertion, what was that like at the beginning of the TDXD? And was that a concern in trying to figure out whether or not she was going to get ILD or not?
Yeah, you know, that has been looked at in clinical trials in terms of safety for the ILD safety signal for TDXD. And it turns out if you have pulmonary symptoms due to pulmonary metastasis, that is not a contraindication to TDXD treatment. In fact, that may be even more reason to administer TDXD is because of those pulmonary symptoms, because that implies you need a rapid response to get control of the metastasis in that organ. Since that's a vital organ, it's really important. So in contrast to other underlying pulmonary conditions, let's say like emphysema or some other chronic pulmonary condition that's benign and non-malignant, those are known risk factors for ILD risk. But symptoms due to underlying disease are not risk factors for ILD due to TDXD.
And with this woman, was she having these, I guess, symptoms she'd had for a while, pulmonary symptoms when you started the TDXD, and did it change at all on the TDXD?
Yeah, it was more or less stable to maybe slightly improved on treatment. And so that's why there was enthusiasm in the early cycles to push on. And she was tolerating the drug particularly well. So there were really no safety signals of concern. We didn't need to do dose modification. And so she was able to enjoy some meaningful duration of stable disease prior to progression. But that's where we're at now.
Peter, how do you think through the clinical use of TDXD in patients who start out with some kind of pulmonary issue? You know, right now, TDXD and non-small cell lung cancer is often used first line in these patients with there is really HER2 mutations. Now also IHC3 plus as well. And of course, a lot of those patients have COPD, cardiovascular disease, et cetera. How do you factor in, you know, underlying conditions, Peter, when you try to decide about using TDXD, and do you monitor them differently?
That's an important question. So I think that there are two points to consider. One is there an increased risk for a patient to develop ILD? And the second is, what is the pulmonary reserve or the capacity? Now, if a patient has pulmonary symptoms down to the cancer, we would hope that they improve with a better response. And TDXD is the drug with a better response. On the other hand, if a patient, for example, had pneumonitis with everolimus, I would be a little bit more anxious about a possible, although the mechanism is slightly different, but another in inflammatory event with the drug. So these are the two things we are looking into. And if a patient has COPD, that's not necessarily a risk factor for ILD. But if a patient has severe COPD and a reduced lung function, that obviously means if a patient may develop light ILD, that can push her over into a higher grade very quickly.
A pulse oximetry, less than 95% was one of the risk factors identified in that study that I presented for increased risk of ILD, interestingly.
Yes, that is interesting. How about your second case here, Mark, this 52-year-old woman?
This is a 52-year-old postmenopausal patient who presented with a palpable right breast mass with no clinically abnormal axillary lymph nodes on first examination. Diagnostic and surgical procedures included mammography, which showed a spiculated mass in the 11 o'clock position. Ultrasound confirmed a 1.8 centimeter solid mass. Core biopsy showed a grade 2 infiltrating carcinoma, which was ERPR positive, HER2 IHC 0, and KI67 20%. Lumpectomy with sentinel lymph node biopsy was performed, which showed a pathologic 2.8 centimeter grade 2 infiltrating carcinoma with two sentinel lymph nodes that were negative for cancer cells. The 21 gene recurrence score was 27 in this case. This was some years ago, so she had adjuvant docetaxel and cyclophosphamide for this condition back then. Radiation therapy as well, and then anastrozole for 5 years. So this is prior to the responder trial data and the like. 3 years after completing anastrozole, the patient had persistent low back pain, radiating to the hips, which restricted her activity. She had a PET CT, which showed FDG uptake in multiple vertebrae and in the bilateral iliac crests. An MRI of the spine showed multiple sclerotic vertebral and pelvic bone lesions without cord compromise. A bone marrow aspirate showed malignant cytokeratin positive cells that were steroid receptor positive. And again, IHC zero. The ECOG performance status was one. Laboratory studies showed only mild anemia and was otherwise normal. So this was her first presentation of metastatic disease. First-line therapy consisted of letrozole with ribociclib, which markedly improved her bone pain. She had a single dose reduction of ribociclib to 400 milligrams due to persistent and significant neutropenia. 20 months after starting CDK4/6 inhibition with an AI, she had a mild increase in her lower back pain. Her laboratories were normal at that time, and a restaging scan showed new FTG avid sclerotic and lytic bone lesions, and a ctDNA analysis confirmed an ESR1 mutation and no evidence of PI3 kinase AKT pathway mutation. She then got elacestrant. She had mild nausea, but that was managed with ondansetron. She was also given some olanzapine, which was helpful for control of GI toxicity in this case. Rapid disease progression, unfortunately, occurred in this case, kind of like what you see in the primary analysis of the elacestrant versus fulvestrant trial in the lower left-hand slide, quadrants of the slide. There are these early progressors on these endocrine agents, and so you have to be mindful of those and be sure to keep your restaging interval on time for that first measure after starting this drug class. She had multiple new liver lesions with some right upper quadrant pain. Review of the prior bone marrow biopsy showed that she did have ultra-low expression levels of HER2 on that specimen. So TDXD then became a potential consideration. She's young in age, no history of lung disease, rapid progression, including LFT abnormalities, endocrine refractory to be sure, normal renal function, and pulse oximetry. And, you know, TDXD in this context in the DB06 trial showed improvement in objective response rate, improved PFS and clinical benefit rates compared to chemotherapy control. And so since that study had just recently been presented, we did discuss it with this patient, as well as a balanced discussion for conventional chemo treatment. And after a long decision-making process, the patient actually chose to move on to capecitabine next, and that's what she's on currently. So currently on capecitabine with stable disease, but it's still early days. This is a fairly recent case.
So, Joyce, any thoughts about this case? And if and when this woman develops disease progression, what are you going to be thinking?
This is a case that I would like to have given her TDXD first line with this rapid progression. And now she's got right upper quadrant pain. Her liver function tests are rising. I'm kind of nervous about this patient. So I think she's a great patient for TDXD. You know, of course, with careful observation, if she doesn't respond quickly, she can certainly switch over to the TDXD very, very quickly. I like Mark's point about with the elacestrant, really getting that first restaging CT a couple months after patients start. Usually with the endocrine therapy, I like to try to push it out 3-4 months, you know, but I think there's a point well taken that half of the patients are not going to respond. They're going to progress by 2 months. So I think that's a good point. So good for her that was done because she was having rapid progression of disease, but I'd rather go with TDXD here. She needs the best response she can at this time.
Just to follow that up, Joyce, because, you know, another thought somewhere at some point in time, this lady might be, for example, sacituzumab. And kind of harkening back to what you were saying about a previous case, do you see like really effective responses to sacituzumab? A patient like this has got a lot of liver disease, right upper quadrant pain. Have you seen people who have good responses to that with sacituzumab?
Yes, I think sacituzumab is a very effective agent, particularly durable responses in HR positive patients. The triple negative patients also respond well. Nothing is as durable as we want in triple negative breast cancer, but I've had patients on sacituzumab for years, many go 12 to 18 months. They oftentimes will require a dose reduction down to 7.5. You don't lose the benefit. It's very well tolerated. It's one of my real strong go-to drugs for HR positive, HER2 negative breast cancer.
So I want to move on to the final module, but first I ask Peter, any thoughts about this case and this discussion?
I mean, I think it comes back to what we said earlier, that we need to get better at identifying early on who's hormone refractory. And as Mark said, the patients really fall off a cliff often with this second line endocrine therapy. One of the particular concerns I have is giving single agent endocrine therapy after combination endocrine therapy first line. And I think with some of the data that have just emerged, if you look at the EMBER trial, that there are new opportunities to give combination therapies with an oral SERD and a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And I think that may be exciting in the future to hopefully make that initial drop a little bit smaller. But if we are good at identifying those patients who are hormone refractory, then of course we need to move on to effective chemotherapy strategies.
Yeah, you know, when all the new endocrine strategies came in, the new agents, the SERDs, et cetera, one of the, my thoughts as I was watching those trials is how bad the control arms were doing on, for example, single agent fulvestrant. I always thought, oh, yeah, they get sequential responses. You give them fulvestrant, they do really well. And, you know, that certainly can happen. But when you looked at those trials, some of them had, you know, PFS like 2-3 months, which is pretty much not very effective. So anyhow, let's finish out. We've already started to get into the issue of adverse events, but let's continue on. And Joyce has a talk that's going to look into that.
Well, thank you, Neil. Yeah, we as oncologists really get better and better over time as we get more and more experience with any particular agent. We really do find out ways to mitigate toxicities. And the TDXD is no different here, I would say. And I want the slides are courtesy of Erica Hamilton. So thank you to Erica. And what I'm going to talk about is the overall incidence. We'll talk about ILD, GI tox, hematologic toxicity, and I have a couple of cases to share as well. So Mark had shown us the safety data from DB06, and shown here are the safety data from DB02, 4, and 3. So both HER2 low and HER2 positive. And we're just looking at the toxicity from the TDXD here. And the main toxicities are GI, and that's the purple up on top. And we can see any grade nausea around 70% and about 5-7% grade 3 nausea. Vomiting going along with the nausea, about half of the patients will have some vomiting. Diarrhea and constipation are pretty well equal. It's not a big feature of this drug, the diarrhea and constipation, unless patients are taking antiemetics that make them constipated, because it's just all low grade. Now, there definitely is some asthenia, fatigue with this drug. About a third of patients will have some. It can be dose limiting, but the grade higher grade is about 5-7%. About 40% of patients will get alopecia. It is temporary. And then myelosuppression is relatively mild with TDXD. There are some patients, a small minority, who get grade 3-4 neutropenia, and there is some thrombocytopenia. About 25% will get any, but very rarely high grade. ILD, about 10-15% of patients will get ILD, but the higher grade is only around 1-2%. And as Mark has said, not all studies, there were not any deaths on DB03, to my knowledge, in the second line setting, even though patients were on, this is the HER2 positive setting, for quite a long time. I didn't hear of any deaths there, but the other studies, DB04 and DB06, there were a few deaths from ILD. So we have to be very aware of that, of course. And speaking of the ILD, this is that very nice paper that Mark showed from Powell et al., ESMO Open 2022, very, very nice kind of meta-analysis across all of the patients who have received TDXD in any of the malignancies. And we see that poor performance status, the higher the number of comorbidities, the poorer the performance status, the poorer the end organ function, it probably leads to higher, less metabolism and clearance of the drug. We do know this is a bit of a dose response relationship with ILD. Japanese ancestry, for sure. There have been early indications that potentially African-American ethnicity could potentially increase risk somewhat. Advanced age, for sure. History of smoking, and as Peter said, a prior history of ILD is a real, a definite increase in risk. And the one we'd see most often is the everolimus, but that would be really a contraindication. We do know that the more heavily pretreated patients are, the higher the risk for ILD. And then very serious, as has been said, you know, with the O2 saturations running less than 95%, serious pre-existing lung disease, pulmonary fibrosis, severe COPD, chronic bronchiectasis with infection, asbestosis, really serious antecedent lung disease really does increase the risk for ILD. So we have really come down, I think, now to this agreement that we need to do some prospective surveillance for ILD for these patients. We're looking, first of all, to educate them. Any kind of a cough that develops, any sort of dyspnea, unexplained fever, or any kind of newer unexplained respiratory symptoms, we need to hear from our patients, you know, right away. We have to ask the patients about that every time they're in the office. So the education is just critically, critically important, as well as to our nursing staff and other members of the team to really know what to listen for. We have to tell patients that this is something that if we don't hear from them quickly, it could develop into a life-threatening or fatal situation. We do want to do CT scans, high-resolution CT scans, every 6 to 12 weeks. I personally like to do a non-contrast chest CT scan. My personal choice is every 9 weeks in general, unless I have a very high risk patient. I don't consult the pulmonologist prospectively unless the patient already has a pulmonologist. Of course, I'll get them on board to start monitoring the patients. And then if there's any question about a patient who's has baseline pulmonary dysfunction, it's actually going to be difficult to evaluate what the TDXD is exacerbating. That's a patient where getting the pulmonologist involved, of course, maybe getting some baseline PFTs, just because it can be difficult to understand what is an exacerbation of underlying pulmonary disease versus an ILD toxicity. So really, really important we get our pulmonologist to really differentiate those, and their PFTs might be useful. I think the main reason to do surveillance for early ILD, asymptomatic grade 1 ILD, is because if we find it, we should hold the TDXD, treat with steroids, get rid of it, get the CT scan to go back to normal. And then because the patient was asymptomatic, she has the opportunity to resume this agent. And the patients are really loath to stop this agent because it generally helps most patients. And after patients kind of adjust to it, they feel very, very well on it. And so I don't want to have to stop it. I don't want to wait for symptoms from the ILD. If they have their chest CT resolve within a month, which is unusual, we can resume at the same dose. Most patients take a bit longer than a month, and so we can resume but a one dose level reduction. But for any symptomatic ILD where patients start to have symptoms and then we get a scan and we see ground glass opacities or infiltrates, et cetera, even though we're not sure exactly what it is, we have to stop the TDXD, definitely treat with steroids. I get the pulmonologist involved at that point if there's something to look at on the CT scan, and we treat them with steroids, but we unfortunately cannot retreat if they are symptomatic. There are data in patients who have asymptomatic grade 1 ILD that we can successfully retreat those patients once their ILD has resolved. A minority of patients will have recurrence of ILD, but it tends to be low grade because, again, we're very vigilant at that point. So we can retreat that asymptomatic grade 1, but not grade 2, certainly, or higher. So this is just a summary. We do want to screen with serial CT scans, and we want to screen clinically as well by talking to patients. And then it's a multidisciplinary effort, mainly with our radiologists and pulmonologists. We want to suspend treatment and then treat with steroids. And if we do this, I feel pretty optimistic that these the rare deaths that we've seen, or even some of the grade three, that we're going to be able to largely prevent that, you know, as we go forward. So the most common toxicity, as I mentioned, is nausea with some emesis that can go along with it. And I think most of us use the highly emetogenic regimen. We use the NK1 receptor antagonist and the 5-HT3 antagonist along with dexamethasone as our prophylaxis prior to the infusion. And then I really think the linchpin, the game changer, thankfully, has been the olanzapine, that 2.5 milligrams starting the night of therapy from day one. I don't wait. I definitely want to prevent the nausea. It's really, really important. We know when patients first get treated with a new therapy, we want to have them have an excellent first experience. So we want to use that olanzapine from day one at nighttime. And I usually continue it for 10 days or longer, the first cycle, and back off from there. But that has been the game changer in terms of getting rid of both acute and, importantly, the small percentage of patients that can have a chronic low-grade nausea. It works exceptionally well. Heme toxicity, thankfully, quite uncommon. There is a small proportion that get grade 3-4 neutropenia. We want to interrupt until they're down to grade 2 or less. If it's grade 3, we can restart the same dose. If it's grade 4 or any febrile neutropenia, we dose reduce a level, but it's really quite uncommon. About a third of patients can get any anemia. We want to do our usual workup for anemia, make sure they're not deficient on iron, B12, folic acid that we can help supplement. We do get a CBC each cycle, of course, and thrombocytopenia, about 50% can get any grade. It's rarely clinically important, but if it does get to grade 3, we do interrupt. If it quickly improves, we can maintain the dose. But if it's grade 4 thrombocytopenia, once it recovers, we reduce the dose. And then LVEF, we're very used to this. Of course, TDXD is trastuzumab. We are getting a baseline cardiac echo. We are repeating it every 3 to 4 months or so. And we have this algorithm here. If the LVEF is above 40% and there's an absolute decrease from baseline is 10% to 20%. So a modest decrease, but they started in the normal range. I usually will start getting a cardiologist involved if I see 10 to 20% falling, even if it's still acceptable to keep going with the TDXD. But if the LVEF is 40 to 49% and the patient gets a 10 to 20% decrease in their LVEF, then I do get the cardiologist involved for sure. They usually will manage the patient medically, provided the patient is asymptomatic. The cardiologists are really very good at, you know, reducing afterload and giving other medications to allow us to keep going if it's between 40 to 49%. However, if the LVEF falls to less than 40%, then we do stop. Of course, we get our cardiology colleagues involved. And usually, once they get above the 40%, with careful cardiac monitoring, we can continue the medication. So if we do need to dose reduce, we go from 5.4 to 4.4 to 3.2, and then we would want to permanently discontinue. And I do think that dose reduction does mitigate some of the toxicities, as we'll have a chance to talk about.
So before we get into your cases, let's see what Mark and Peter have to say. Mark, I was talking about this ADC symposium that at San Antonio was so great. And one of the slides that flew by me and wasn't discussed that much, but I went back and looked at it, was they were talking about HER2 being expressed on the pulmonary macrophage, and that maybe that had something to do with ILD, which I'd never heard before. Have you ever heard of that or anything about that?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard of that either, Neil, but I have heard of Mike Press's publication back in 1994 where he described HER2 expression on normal pulmonary epithelium. So I know it's expressed in the epithelial compartment as well, according to Mike's data. And, you know, for my armchair understanding of mechanism of ILD, I think that that probably is an important arbiter of you know, the toxicity that we observe. It's, I think it's directly against the pulmonary epithelium. Macrophage contribution maybe notwithstanding. I still think that the fact that it's expressed in pulmonary epithelium is important.
And yeah, little things like that always catch my attention. Joyce, why don't we flip into your cases here, starting out with this 48-year-old lady.
So this woman is a 48-year-old full-time school teacher, initially diagnosed with a grade 3 7-centimeter node positive, ERPR positive, HER2 1 plus FISH negative invasive ductal breast cancer with germline testing negative, and received a preoperative dose dense AC, then weekly paclitaxel at mastectomy, 3-centimeter residual disease, 1 of 4 positive lymph nodes, had post-mastectomy radiation and initiated leuprolide and exemestane, which she was adherent with. And 4 years later, unfortunately, developed bone and right inguinal lymph node recurrence. Biopsy of the inguinal lymph node showed ERPR positive disease. Now HER2 is 2+, FISH negative, 2+ by IHC. She received fulvestrant plus abemaciclib and had 26 months response, then developed progression in bone, now with multiple new liver metastasis. Both ctDNA and NGS of the primary breast cancer showed no targetable mutations. She was treated with capecitabine, had 12 months response, and then her liver disease progressed. She was then treated with trastuzumab deruxtecan. We started with the antiemetic premeds of dexamethasone, palonosetron, and fosaprepitant, but she experienced daily low-grade nausea and vomiting that interfered with her ability to work, and it was not helped with ondansetron, lorazepam, or prochlorperazine. She really wanted to discontinue TDXD rather strenuously, but agreed to the addition of olanzapine. This is quite a while ago before we knew for sure we had to start with it, but she started cycle 2 with the 2.5 milligrams, and it was a night and day situation. She had substantially less nausea that was grade 1. She still had a little and transient, and her bone and liver metastasis responded for 15 months to the TDXD, and she was able to get back to working full time. So the olanzapine was basically saved her opportunity to benefit from the TDXD.
So, Peter, any thoughts about this case and also the issue of GI toxicity and other quality of life issues that come up in these cases?
Yeah, I think the management of AEs with ADC is really critical. And it's one of the areas where we've seen in our own practice, we had a very steep learning curve. And if you look at the data from the initial trials, whether it's with TDXD in terms of fatigue and nausea, or whether it's, for example, with sacituzumab govitecan in terms of gastrointestinal side effects, diarrhea, we see those side effects now much less frequently. Actually, we hardly ever see, for example, diarrhea with sacituzumab govitecan, and nausea, again, we see very little because we apply in a very strict way, prophylactic co-medication in the way Joyce has mentioned it. And if you look at the initial trials that didn't have triple prophylaxis from an antiemetic point of view, if this is strictly applied, the incidence and severity of nausea drops dramatically. And then with additional drugs such as olanzapine, we can usually control this well. So I think that's really important. And a lot of clinicians out there initially felt these new ADCs are toxic compounds. But I would say if you and your team learns how to manage side effects, these are well-tolerated treatments.
So, Mark, you know, of course, now TDXD is all throughout solid tumor oncology. Now there's a pan-tumor approval. And it's very interesting because now you have, you know, GU docs and GI docs, et cetera, who have less experience with TDXD than the average general medical oncologist. You know, we did a program, I think it was at the GU oncology meeting, where we were talking about this. And I actually showed a video, not of a GU doc, but of a breast cancer doc talking about how she deals with toxicity from TDXD. And then when the moderator asked somebody on the panel, like, well, what would you do? You kind of said, I'd do what she just said, because they really don't have any experience with it. Any thoughts about the need to kind of get beyond, you know, breast cancer investigators into other investigators? And also, you know, sort of the biology behind toxicity of ADCs. I'd also curious about your thoughts on that. Again, at this ADC meeting at San Antonio, they were pointing out that everybody thinks about the payload. I guess that's the most common reason for toxicity, but that theoretically can also get toxicity from the linker or the antibody. So any thoughts about those two issues, Mark, both where the toxicity comes from with ADCs and also this issue of trying to get your other investigator colleagues sort of up to speed?
I think the good news is that essentially all oncologists, certainly clinical investigators in the field, are well-versed and highly experienced in managing nausea from chemotherapy because of all the other chemo that's given for every other tumor type in solid tumor malignancy. Moreover, patients are very vocal about nausea because it really is upsetting and uncomfortable. And so those doctors will learn right away that if the prophylactic regimen that was administered on cycle one was not sufficient on all following cycles, they sure will use, the highest level of prophylaxis possible. It is a tough lesson to learn. It would be nice if they were aware that that needs to be done on cycle one. I think the description of nausea to TDXD has recently been changed from moderately emetic to highly emetic. So as long as they got that message, and if they have electronic ordering for their chemotherapy administration in their department, that's an easy way to intervene also. You just make the default the highly anti-emetic regimen on cycle one, and that way they can't really get it wrong because it's already in the pre-programmed electronic ordering system the way it should be. Second question.
Yeah, how the toxicities occur. Is it always the payload, or can you get toxicity from the other elements?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't think we have a definitive answer, certainly not in the clinic. You know, we haven't done experiments where we've given linker alone to see what it does, et cetera. So theoretically, there might be something to the linker fragment still attached to the payload, but that's true of all of the antibody-drug conjugates that I'm aware of. They, for example, TDM1 is the linker, the payload, and the lysine amino acid residue from the trastuzumab backbone that it was chemically conjugated to in the first place. That's all there as the cytotoxic moiety that kills cancer cells. So we're stuck with that. There may be metabolites of those species as well that nobody likes to think about. There could easily be M1 or M2 metabolites that have as much or more toxicity as the parent compound. And so that's another line of investigation. If you really wanted to look at this critically, you'd have to not only look at the linker payload, but all of its metabolites potentially to see which one is most responsible for a particular toxicity.
So yeah, Peter, I'm always trying to, you know, enhance my knowledge of sort of the biology of how these various agents work. And again, I really learned a lot from the symposium. And another thing they talked a lot about was the issue of mechanisms of resistance to ADCs. Again, a lot of focus on the payload. And I don't know, I just had never really thought about the fact that at least up to now, the payloads are chemo, and that essentially you're getting chemo-related toxicity from some of these ADCs. Any thoughts about that? And also in terms of mechanisms of resistance, they were saying a lot of it is the same resistance you see to IV chemotherapy. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think if you look at toxicity, there are typical antibody-driven toxicities, there are chemo-driven toxicities, and there are some toxicities that are a combination of both and ADC-driven. And similarly, if you look at efficacy and therefore at resistance, some of the resistance is driven to the antibody or to the target, and some of the resistance is driven by the payload. In reality, my impression is that with the current generation of ADCs, the resistance is more driven by payloads. And I think that's relevant when we want to think about sequential treatments, because at the moment, although we have exciting different targets, we have a lack of different chemotherapy agents. And what we're doing is essentially giving paclitaxel after docetaxel after nab-paclitaxel with the different ADCs. And that's not the most clever strategy. So I think where we need to move to is is have different groups of chemotherapy agents or other things be conjugated to an antibody, and then have rational sequential ADC strategies. Maybe, for example, choose the first, let's say, topoisomerase one payload ADC based on the highest expression of the target, and then move to a second ADC with a non-cross-resistant payload. But that's future, and we're quite a few steps away from that.
Neil, I have an interesting mechanism of ADC resistance you might be interested to hear about. Michael Basick and his lab at Stanford recently published a paper on TDM1 resistance. And what they found using a CRISPR screen is that since TDM1 requires trafficking all the way from the early to late endosomes, all the way to the lysosome, for its mechanism, it must be degraded in the lysosome. Otherwise, it won't work. And what Michael's graduate student discovered was that in the CRISPR screen, there was a family of endolysosomal trafficking proteins that were dysregulated, leading to TDM1 resistance. That has not yet been confirmed with clinical specimens, but I think that it needs to be, because it's such an appealing mechanism for that drug, that these trafficking chaperones are necessary to function to deliver the drug all the way to the lysosome, which is necessary for its efficacy action. So I thought that was just fascinating, and it's a mechanism I hadn't really considered previously.
There's also another observation we see increasingly. That's what I would describe as oligoprogression. And if a patient has 10 metastatic sites, 9 may be responding, 1 has developed resistance. And I think that clonal evolution of resistance is a little bit more pronounced with ADCs than what we've seen with conventional chemotherapy. And that allows us to use targeted radiotherapy in patients with oligoprogression and keeping patients on their systemic therapy. And I think there's a lot we're going to change and learn in the next years.
That's really interesting. Joyce, before we go into your last case, anything you want to add on to this? You know, again, one of the things they were talking about was that, again, the idea that when you see resistance to the payload, it's, quote, like chemotherapy resistance. And I was trying to remember, because it was so long ago, like, what do we know about mechanisms of resistance just to regular chemotherapy?
Well, we know that if SN38, for example, with sacituzumab, can't bind to topoisomerase 1, and there's a mutation right where SN38 binds in with sacituzumab, the MGH group had published that, I think, in Cancer Discovery. SN38 can't bind, you can't inhibit topoisomerase 1. And then I thought, well, gee, maybe deruxtecan doesn't bind in exactly the same place. But apparently it's close enough. The steric changes that occur with that mutation in topoisomerase 1 doesn't allow binding of topo 1 inhibitors there, and so it doesn't inhibit it. That's very similar to what we see in chemotherapy. It's very common for microtubules, tubulin, to mutate, right, where the taxane or the vinca is supposed to bind. So it's very common the binding site of these cytotoxic agents on the target gets mutated. And so I think we're seeing the same thing. I do think, however, that the expression of the target is going to also be another consideration. We saw that. We saw that again with sacituzumab, and I must say it was disappointing to see it was in the same patient who had benefited from sacituzumab, and then the disease evolved, and they biopsied the progressing disease, and she had the topoisomerase 1 enzyme had mutated, so SN38 couldn't bind, but also TROP2 was mutant, and it would not stick in the plasma membrane. It was floating around in the cytoplasm in the same patient. So we're gonna need an understanding of expression going forward. I think I foresee a day where we're gonna be able to get a biopsy, and we're gonna have a very highly quantitative and sensitive assay, such as reverse phase protein array or other mass spec or other, where we're gonna be able to look right across the board. We're gonna have a lot of targets to go after. And we're going to want to know how to sequence these based on target expression. And also the mutations in TROP2 and topoisomerase 1 could potentially be picked up in ctDNA. So hopefully our panels will expand to show us that that's evolving, at least subclonally.
We just did a webinar on chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and we were getting into all the mutations that occur when people are on BTK inhibitors, and now they have three different generations of BTK inhibitors and different mutations that they see there. So maybe we'll be heading in the same direction. Okay, let's finish out with this 60-year-old woman, Joyce.
So this patient, 60-year-old, recurred with bone-only ER-positive HER2-2+, but FISH-negative breast cancer 4 years after completing 5 years of adjuvant AI for stage one breast cancer. And she had severe thoracic pain, required radiation therapy. She received letrozole and palbociclib for 30 months, and then her disease progressed in bone. ctDNA showed no targetable mutation. She received exemestane everolimus, and she had 9 months of response, and then her disease progressed bone only still. ctDNA showed no targetable mutations still. So she received then capecitabine and had 12 months benefit. And then her disease progressed in bone with severe lumbar pain as well as in liver, multiple metastases. Now she's got a PIK3CA mutation and FGFR1 amplification. Hemoglobin A1C was 7%. She was initiated on TDXD with scalp cooling and with nightly olanzapine, which she tolerated well. And she still had about a 20% hair loss or so. She had a marked improvement in her bone pain with the TDXD, and the liver metastasis responded. After 4 months, she developed grade 2 fatigue that was interfering with her daily exercise and overall well-being. We tried some bupropion, but it was not effective, and she declined amphetamine therapy. So we reduced her dose of TDXD down to 4.4 mg per kg, and it actually made a acceptable improvement in her fatigue. And then at cycle 6, non-contrast chest CT that we get every 3 cycles showed new ground glass opacities in both lower lobes. She was asymptomatic, no cough, shortness of breath, dyspnea, fever, no change in her exercise capacity. So the TDXD was held, and she saw a pulmonologist who began treatment with prednisone 60 milligrams daily, which was weaned down over 4 weeks, and repeat chest CT showed near resolution of the ground glass opacities. And so she began treatment with a PPI in the morning because she had noticed some postprandial GERD symptoms, which could have actually even been contributing to the ground glass opacity we were seeing. So she restarted the 4.4 mg per kg, and CT surveillance every 8 weeks showed nothing to suggest ILD. So I didn't reduce the dose further at that point. So she was able to stay on the TDXD for another 11 months with really good tolerability until disease progression. So we were able to manage dose limiting fatigue as well as some grade 1 ILD with early intervention and keep her on this drug.
So, wow, what a saga. That's an incredible case. Peter, any thoughts about the case? I'm curious, do you generally use scalp cooling in your patients? And do you use it in your patients who get TDXD? And any comments on the issue of fatigue in TDXD?
So we use, we offer scalp cooling routinely to all patients. The efficacy is very different between different chemotherapy agents. Obviously, it works fantastically well with taxanes. Works less well with anthracyclines, but still to some effect. Our experience with ADCs and TDXD in particular is not that encouraging. And my theory has always been the half-life of the drug is just very different. And if you stop the scalp cooling with the drug still in the system, it obviously, you almost have hyperemia in the scalp. And actually, I don't think it works as well as we would like to. So we still offer it to patients because it's very difficult to say, I don't have it, but the experience is pretty limited. Fatigue is interesting. We initially, when we started work with TDXD, we saw a lot of fatigue. My impression is we see much less fatigue these days. I think this is partly because we also manage some of the other side effects, especially nausea, better. And I think there's a link between nausea and fatigue in some of those patients. But also we are probably a little bit more proactive with adjusting the dose if it is required. So in our day-to-day practice, fatigue is no longer a big problem.
So, Mark, anything you want to add to that? And also, I noticed this patient has an FGFR mutation. I'm not sure the FGFR inhibitors we have out there, even if they do work outside of the, I don't know, biliary or other cancers, whether or not they're ever worth considering, or whether we've seen any data on that in breast cancer. Any thoughts again about this case, the scalp cooling, the fatigue management, and also whether the FGFR would be a target you think about?
We've used scalp cooling for TDXD at our institution. And anecdotally, we've had some patients who claimed victory, but one wonders, are those the patients who might not have been bothered much by alopecia from TDXD anyway? Because there are some patients that have very little alopecia with the agent. Perhaps 40 to 50% will get alopecia, but the rest don't. So I don't know whether our anecdote was due to the intervention or whether that was a play of chance. In terms of FGFR inhibition, we have had clinical trials of FGFR inhibitors for steroid receptor positive breast cancers at our center. It's for much earlier stage treatment for that particular trial, so this patient would not have been eligible for that study. And so consequently, off protocol, I can't recommend it because I've never seen any data showing efficacy in breast cancer as yet. And then I very definitely have had a couple of patients on long-term TDXD who did experience significant fatigue, and it was mitigated nicely simply by using the next lower dose level, and that was very successful in managing that particular complication. But it was people that have been up for a long time, not patients that are early on in the first few months. It's usually later on when you start to see cumulative fatigue due to long-term treatment, my experience.
So the last question I want to throw out to the three of you sort of goes a little bit beyond the topic here of HER2-low, but I think is sort of in the middle of it and maybe will relate to HER2-low, which is the potential use of TDXD in the first-line metastatic setting. I think it's a DB09. I always forget which number it is, but there's a trial cooking out there with TDXD plus or minus pertuzumab, which a lot of people, Joyce, are thinking is going to be positive. First, I don't know, any suggestion about when we might see the data, and the day that we wake up in the morning and check our phones and see, oh, yeah, there's a press release saying the trial is wildly positive, what's going to be happening?
I don't know for sure, but I'm hearing there's going to be a lot of TDXD data at ASCO. And it's interesting because in the DB09 trial, patients stay on the TDXD for as long as they're benefiting. A question of plus minus pertuzumab benefit, you know, let's put that aside for one moment and focus on how we're going to manage the TDXD. Because the issue is, do we treat as an induction therapy till maximum response and then go over to HP, or do we continue until some time of, you know, some cumulative toxicity and then go over to HP? And the reason that's important, that there are four trials in the first line metastatic trying to enhance maintenance HP. And we saw the first one from San Antonio, the Patina trial, adding palbociclib to endocrine therapy and HP in HR positive, HER2 positive patients, a 15 month improvement in PFS, very well tolerated. So like, oh, well, gee, that's a nice strategy for the HR positive patients. And then we have the HER2CLIMB-05 trial, which is both for HR positive and HR negative patients. They're getting their maintenance HP. If they're ER positive, they're on endocrine therapy. And then it's plus minus tucatinib. So that's very interesting to really go after that HER family tremendously, both HR positive and ER positive. Very, very interesting. And then there's the ANAVO-122, I think it is, and that's for PIK3CA mutant patients. You know, PIK3CA patients we saw in Cleopatra, they don't do as well with the Cleopatra regimen. They get is much shorter PFS. And so that is also for HR positive and HR negative patients. And so they're randomized to plus minus anavolisib. There is a fourth one that also looks at giredestrant. It's the Heredera trial. And so patients who are HR positive, HER2 positive, once they get onto their maintenance HP without chemo, the chemo stopped in all of these, then they're randomized to their standard endocrine therapy versus the oral SERD giredestrant, regardless of ESR1 mutation status. So there's some very interesting, we're going to have to see all these data, Neil, and we're going to have to figure out how to optimize different patient populations.
It's funny when you said maybe, who knows, maybe at ASCO, I had this sort of flashback. I saw Edith Perez at San Antonio, and I did just a regular interview with her in February, I think it was 2005, and I had no idea. She said, hey, guess what? We're going to be presenting the adjuvant trials at ASCO. And I'm like, whoa, nobody had any idea at that point. So that's the first I heard that maybe that'd be great if we could see it that early, but it should be coming soon. Mark, anything you want to add to Joyce's really thoughtful comments?
No, it's going to be a difficult decision if DESTINY-Breast09 is positive for either of the two TDXD arms, what to do with that data in the wake of the PATINA trial. So I think that's spot on. Moreover, the start of the PFS clock on PATINA was after they already completed their taxane plus dual antibody therapy. So it's not the time from first diagnosis of metastasis to progression. It's the time from when they finish their taxane until progression. So that's handicapped a little bit, although you could say that maybe that's the reason the results look so spectacular, is the early progressors who progressed while they were on taxane and the dual antibodies were excluded from PATINA, and maybe that's why their outcomes were particularly good. So that's a confounding variable to take into consideration also if you're trying to do cross-trial thought experiments between those two studies. So it'll be very interesting. I have no idea whether pertuzumab will add to TDXD. I will guess that it will, but I said the same thing about the Marianne trial with T-DM1, and it didn't. So I'm torn, and I'll be very anxious to see whether pertuzumab will be rehabilitated and stay on with TDXD, or whether it will be made redundant.
Final comment from Peter.
I think the HER2-high disease will be really interesting to see how it's all shifting, because we as everyone said, toxicity is a key driver, and we see. We see substantial activity with TDXD in second, third line setting. So we always know that we can salvage those patients. I think the Athena data were really interesting and bring us back to an area where I think we have been missing the trick for a long time, and that is focusing on ER strategies in HER2 positive disease. And that just showed us what the potential might be. There's obviously a question, as Mark says, about patient selection, but still it is a pretty spectacular signal we are seeing there. And that needs to be taken into consideration. So I think we'll get those new data in. I think it will be very clear that PDXD will be superior in a frontline setting. But whether that is enough to change everything we are doing will require quite a bit more work.
So I think everybody's holding their breath until we see that data. That should be the presentation of the decade, maybe. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Striving for Consensus, Current and Future Management of HER2-Low and Ultra-Low Breast Cancer.